Blue Mars, Cassette 6. He sat in a blaze of noise. Then the speeches were over, and they had shifted into some kind of public press conference, responding to questions asked by the beautiful woman in the green sari. Nergal responded with questions of his own, asking her about the new compound of buildings surrounding them and about the situation on the island. And she answered over a chatter of commentary and laughter from the appreciative crowd, still looking on from behind the wall of reporters and cameras. The woman turned out to be the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. The little two-island nation had been unwillingly dominated by the Medinat Arms Corps for most of the previous century, the woman explained, and only since the flood had they severed that association. And every colonial bond at last. How the crowd cheered, and her smile so full of a whole society's pleasure. She was Dougla, he saw, and amazingly beautiful. The compound they were in, she explained, was one of scores of relief hospitals that had been built on the two islands since the flood. Their construction had been the major project of the islanders in response to their new freedom. They had created relief centers that aided flood victims, giving them all at once housing, work, and medical care, including the longevity treatment. "Everyone gets the treatment?" Nergal asked. "Yes," the woman said. "Good," Nergal said, surprised. He had heard it was a rare thing on Earth. "You think so?" the Prime Minister said. "People are saying it will create all kinds of problems." "Yes, it will, in fact. But I think we should do it anyway. Give everyone the treatment and then figure out what to do." It was a minute or two before anything more could be heard over the cheering of the crowd. The Prime Minister was trying to quiet them, but a short man dressed in a fashionable brown suit came out of the group behind the Prime Minister and proclaimed into the mic, to an uproar of cheers at every sentence, "This Marsman Nergal is a son of Trinidad. His papa, Desmond Hawkins, the stowaway, the Coyote of Mars, is from Port of Spain, and he still has a lot of people there. That Arms Corps bought the oil company, and they tried to buy the island, too, but they picked the wrong island to try. Your Coyote didn't get his spirit from out of the air, Maestro Nergal. He got it from TNT. He's been wandering around up there teaching everyone the TNT way, and they're all up there Dougla anyway. They understand the Dougla way, and they have taken over all Mars with it. Mars is one great big Trinidad Tobago." The crowd went into transports at this, and impulsively Nergal walked over to the man and hugged him, such a smile. Then found the stairs and got down and walked out into the crowd which clumped around him. A miasma of fragrances, too loud to think. He touched people, shook hands, people touched him, the look in their eyes. Everyone was shorter than he was, they laughed at that. And every face was an entire world. Black dots swam in his vision, things went darker very abruptly. He looked around, startled. A bank of clouds had massed over a dark strip of sea to the west, and the lead edge had cut off the sun. Now, as he continued to mingle, the cloud bank came rolling over the island. The crowd broke up as people moved under the shelter of trees or verandas or a big tin-roofed bus stop. Maya and Sax and Michelle were lost in their own crowds. The clouds were dark gray at their bases, rearing up in white roils as solid as rock but mutable, flowing continuously. A cool wind struck hard, and then big raindrops starred the dirt, and the four Martians were hustled under an open pavilion roof where room was made for them. Then the rain poured down like nothing Nergal had ever seen, rain sheeting down, roaring, slamming into sudden broad rivering puddles, all starred with a million white droplet explosions, the whole world outside the pavilion blurred by falling water into patches of color, green and brown, all mixed in a wash. Maya was grinning.
"It's like the ocean is falling on us."
"So much water," Nergal said. The Prime Minister shrugged. "It happens every day during monsoon. It's more rain than before, and we already got a lot." Nergal shook his head and felt a stabbing at his temples, the pain of breathing in wet air, half drowning. The Prime Minister was explaining something to them, but Nergal could barely follow, his head hurt so. Anyone in the independence movement could join a Praxis affiliate, and during their first year's work, they were building relief centers like this one. The longevity treatment was an automatic part of every person's joining, administered in the newly built centers. Birth control implants could be had at the same time, reversible but permanent if left in. Many took them as their contribution to the cause. "Babies later," we say. "There will be time." People wanted to join anyway. Almost everyone had. Arms Corps had been forced to match the Praxis arrangement to keep some of their people, and so it made little difference now what organization one was part of. On Trinidad, they were all much the same. The newly treated went on to build more housing, or work in agriculture, or make more hospital equipment. Trinidad had been fairly prosperous before the flood, the combined result of vast oil reserves and Metanat investment in the cable socket. There had been a progressive tradition which had formed the basis of the resistance in the years after the unwelcome Metanat arrival. Now there was a growing infrastructure dedicated to the longevity project. It was a promising situation. Every camp was a waiting list for the treatment, working on its own construction. Of course, people were absolutely firm in the defense of such places. Even if Arms Corps had wanted to, it would be very difficult for its security forces to take over the camps. And if they did, they would find nothing of value to them anyway. They already had the treatment. So they could try genocide if they wanted to, but other than that, they had few options for taking back control of the situation. "The island just walked away from them," the Prime Minister concluded. "No army can stop that. It's an end to economic caste of all kind. This is something new, a new Dubla thing in history, like you said in your speech, like a little Mars. So to have you here to see us, you a grandchild of the island, you who have taught us so much in your beautiful new world, oh, it is a special thing. A festival for real." That radiant smile. Who was the man who spoke? Oh, that was James. Abruptly, the rain let up. The sun broke through and the world steamed. Sweat poured down Nergal in the white air. He couldn't catch his breath. White air, black spots swimming. "I think I need to lie down."
"Oh, yes, yes, of course. You must be exhausted, overwhelmed. Come with us."
They took him to a small outbuilding of the compound, into a bright room walled with bamboo strips, empty except for a mattress on the floor.
"I'm afraid the mattress is not long enough for you."
"It doesn't matter." He was left alone. Something about the room reminded him of the interior of Hiroko's cottage in the grove on the far side of the lake in Zygote. Not just the bamboo, but the room's size and shape, and something elusive, the green light streaming in, perhaps. The sensation of Hiroko's presence was so strong and so unexpected that when the others had left the room, Nergal threw himself down on the mattress, his feet hanging far off the bottom edge, and cried. A complete confusion of feeling. His whole body hurt, but especially his head. He stopped crying and fell into a deep sleep. He woke in a small black chamber,
It smelled green. He couldn't remember where he was. He rolled onto his back, and it came to him. Earth. Whispers. He sat up, frightened. A muffled laugh. Hands caught at him and pressed him down, but they were friendly hands. He could feel that immediately. Shh, someone said, and then kissed him. Someone else was fumbling at his belt, his buttons. Women. Two. Three. No, two. Scented overpoweringly with jasmine and something else. Two strands of perfume, both warm. Sweaty skin, so slick. The arteries in his head pounded. This kind of thing had happened to him once or twice when he was younger, when the newly tented canyons were like new worlds, with new young women who wanted to get pregnant or just have fun. After the celibate months of the voyage, it felt like heaven to squeeze women's bodies, to kiss and be kissed, and his initial fright melted away in a rush of hands and mouths, breasts and tangled legs. "Sister Earth," he gasped. There was music coming from somewhere far away, piano and steel drums and tablas, almost washed out by the sound of the wind in the bamboo. One of the women was on top of him, pressed down on him, and the feel of her ribs sliding under his hands would stay with him forever. He came inside her, kept on kissing, but his head still pounded painfully. The next time he woke, he was damp and naked on the mattress. It was still dark. He dressed and went out of the room, down a dim hallway to an enclosed porch. It was dusk. He had slept through a day. Maya and Michelle and Sax were sitting down to a meal with a large group. Nergal assured them he was fine, ravenous, in fact. He sat among them. Out in the clearing, in the middle of the raw, wet compound, a crowd was gathered around an outdoor kitchen. Beyond them, a bonfire blazed yellow in the dusk. Its flames limned the dark faces and reflected in the bright liquid whites of their eyes, their teeth. The people at the inside table all looked at him. Several of the young women smiled, their jet hair like caps of jewels, and for a second Nergal was afraid he smelled of sex and perfume. But the smoke from the bonfire and the steamy scents of the spiced dishes on the table made such a thing irrelevant. In such an explosion of smells, nothing could be traced to its origin. And anyway, one's olfactory system was blasted by the food, hot with spices, curry and cayenne, chunks of fish on rice with a vegetable that seared his mouth and throat, so that he spent the next half hour blinking and sniffing and drinking glasses of water, his head burning. Someone gave him a slice of candied orange, which cooled his mouth somewhat. He ate several slices of bittersweet candied orange. When the meal was over, they all cleared the tables together as in Zygote or Haranyagarbha. Outside, dancers began to circle the bonfire, dressed in their surreal carnival costumes with masks of beasts and demons over their heads, as during Fastnacht in Nicosia, although the masks were heavier and stranger. Demons with multiple eyes and big teeth. Elephants. Goddesses. The trees were black against the blurry black of the sky, the stars all fat and swinging around, the fronds and leaves up there green, black, black, green, and then fire-colored as the flames leaped higher, seeming to provide the rhythm of the dance. A small young woman with six arms, all moving together to the dance, stepped behind Nergal and Maya. "This is the dance of Ramayana," she told them. "It is as old as civilization, and in it they speak of Mangala." She gave Nergal a familiar squeeze on the shoulder, and suddenly he recognized her jasmine scent. Without smiling, she went back out to the bonfire. The tabla drums were following the leaping flames to a crescendo, and the dancers cried out. Nergal's head throbbed at every beat, and despite the candied orange, his eyes were still watering from the burning pepper, and his lids were heavy. "I know it's strange," he said, "but I think I have to sleep again."
He woke before dawn and went out on a veranda to watch the sky lighten in a quite Martian sequence, black to purple to rose to pink, before turning the startling cyanic blue of a tropical Terran morning. His head was still sore, as if stuffed, but he felt rested at last and ready to take on the world again. After a breakfast of green-brown bananas, he and Sax joined some of their hosts for a drive around the island. Everywhere they went, there were always several hundred people in his field of vision. The people were all small, brown-skinned like him in the countryside, darker in the towns. There were big vans that moved around together, providing mobile shops to villages too small to have them. Nergal was surprised to see how lean people were, their limbs wiry with labor or else as thin as reeds. In this context, the curves of the young women were like the blooms of flowers, not long for this world. When people saw who he was, they rushed up to greet him and shake his hand. Sax shook his head at the sight of Nergal among them. "Bimodal distribution," he said. "Not speciation exactly, but perhaps if enough time passed. Island divergence. It's very Darwinian."
"I'm a Martian," Nergal agreed. Their buildings were placed in holes hacked into the green jungle, which then tried to take the space back. The older buildings were all made of mud bricks, black with age, melting back into the earth. Rice fields were terraced so finely that the hills looked farther away than they really were. The light green of rice shoots was a color never seen on Mars. In general, the greens were brilliant and glowing beyond anything Nergal could recall seeing. They pressed on him, so various and intense, the sun plating his back.
"It's because of the sky's color," Sax said when Nergal mentioned it. "The reds in the Martian sky mute the greens just a bit." The air was thick, wet, rancid. The shimmering sea settled on a distant horizon. Nergal coughed, breathed through his mouth, struggled to ignore his throbbing temples and forehead. "You have low altitude sickness," Sax speculated. "I've read claims that it happens to Himalayans and Andeans who come down to sea level. Acidity levels in the blood. We ought to have landed you someplace higher."
"Why didn't we?"
"They wanted you here because Desmond came from here. This is your homeland. Actually, there seems to be a bit of conflict over who should host us next."
"Even here?"
"More here than on Mars, I should think."
Nergal groaned. The weight of the world, the stifling air. "I'm going running," he said, and took off. At first, it was its usual release. The habitual motions and responses poured through him, reminding him that he was still himself. But as he thumped along, he didn't ascend into that Lungompa zone where running was like breathing, something he could do indefinitely. Instead, he began to feel the press of the thick air in his lungs, and the pressure of eyes from the little people he passed, and most of all the pressure of his own weight, hurting his joints. He weighed more than twice what he was used to, and it was like carrying an invisible person on his back, except, no, the weight was inside him. As if his bones had turned to lead inside him. His lungs burned and drowned at the same time, and no cough would get them clear. There were taller people in Western clothes behind him now, on little three-wheeled bicycles that splashed through every puddle. But locals were stepping into the road behind him, crowds of them blocking off the tricyclers, their eyes and teeth gleaming in their dark faces as they talked and laughed. The men on the tricycles had blank faces, and they were looking at Nergal, but they didn't challenge the crowd. Nergal headed back toward the camp, turning down a new road. Now the green hills were blazing to his right. The road jarred up through his legs with every step until his legs were like tree trunks aflame. That running should hurt, and his head was like a giant balloon. All the wet green plants seemed to be reaching out for him, 100 shades of green flame melding to one dominant color band, pouring into the world. Black dots swimming. "Hiroko!" he gasped, and ran on with the tears streaming down his face. No one would be able to tell them from sweat. "Hiroko, it isn't like you said it would be." He stumbled into the ochre dirt of the compound, and scores of people followed him to Maya. Soaking as he was, he still threw his arms around her and put his head down on her shoulder, sobbing. "We should get to Europe," Maya said angrily to someone over his back. "This is stupid to bring him right to the tropics like this." Nergal shifted to look back. It was the Prime Minister. "This is how we always live," she said, and pierced Nergal with a resentful, proud look. But Maya was unimpressed. "We have to go to Bern," she said. They flew to Switzerland in a small space plane provided by Praxis. As they traveled, they looked down on the Earth from 30,000 meters, the blue Atlantic, the rugged mountains of Spain, somewhat like the Hellespontus Montes, then France, then the white wall of the Alps, unlike any mountains he had ever seen. The cool ventilation of the space plane felt like home to Nergal, and he was chagrined to think that he couldn't tolerate the open air of Earth. "You'll do better in Europe," Maya told him. Nergal thought about the reception they had gotten. "They love you here," he said. Overwhelmed as he had been, he had still noticed that the welcome of the Douglas had been as enthusiastic for the other three ambassadors as for him, and Maya had been particularly cherished. "They're happy we survived," Maya said, dismissing it. "We came back from the dead, as far as they're concerned, like magic. They thought we were dead, do you see? From 61 until just last year, they thought all the first 100 were dead. 67 years. And all that time, part of them was dead, too. To have us come back like we have, and in this flood with everything changing, yes, it's like a myth. The return from underground." "But not all of you." "No." She almost smiled. "They still have to sort that out. They think Frank is alive, and Arkady, and John, too, even though John was killed years before 61, and everyone knew it. For a while, anyway. But people are forgetting things. That was a long time ago. And so much has happened since, and people want John Boone to be alive. And so they forget Nicosia and say that he's part of the underground still." She laughed shortly, unsettled by this. "Like with Hiroko," Nergal said, feeling his throat constrict. A wave of sadness like the one in Trinidad washed through him, leaving him bleached and aching. He believed, he had always believed, that Hiroko was alive and hiding with her people somewhere in the southern highlands. This was how he had coped with the shock of the news of her disappearance, by being quite certain that she had slipped out of Sabashi and would show up again when she felt the time was right. He had been sure of it. Now, for some reason he couldn't tell, he was no longer sure. In the seat on the other side of Maya, Michel sat with a pinched expression on his face. Suddenly Nergal felt like he was looking in a mirror. He knew his face held the same expression. He could feel it in his muscles. He and Michel both had doubts, perhaps about Hiroko, perhaps about other things. No way of telling. Michel didn't seem inclined to speak. And from across the plain, Sax watched them both with his usual bird-like gaze. They dropped out of the sky, paralleling the great north wall of the Alps, and landed on a runway among green fields. They were escorted through a cool Mars-like building, downstairs and onto a train, which slid metallically up and out of the building and across green fields. And in an hour, they were in Bern. In Bern, the streets were mobbed by diplomats and reporters, everyone with an ID badge on their chest, everyone with a mission to speak to them. The city was small and pristine and rock solid. The feeling of gathered power was palpable. Narrow, stone-flagged streets were flanked by thick arcaded stone buildings, everything as permanent as a mountain, with the swift river Ara essing through it, holding the main part of town in one big oxbow. The people crowding that quarter were mostly Europeans, meticulous-looking white people, not as short as most Terrans, milling around, absorbed in their talk, and always a good number of them clustering around the Martians and their escorts, who now were blue-uniformed Swiss military police. Nergal and Sax and Michel and Maya were given rooms in the Praxis headquarters in a small stone building just above the Ara River. It amazed Nergal how close to water the Swiss were willing to build. A rise in the river of even 2 meters would spell disaster, but they didn't care. Apparently they had the river under control that tight, even though it came out of the steepest mountain range Nergal had ever seen. Terraforming indeed. It was no wonder the Swiss were good on Mars. The Praxis building was just a few streets from the old center of the city. The World Court occupied a scattering of offices next to the Swiss federal buildings near the middle of the peninsula. So every morning they walked down the cobbled main street, the Kramgasse, which was incredibly clean, bare, and underpopulated compared with any street and port of Spain. They passed under the medieval clock tower, with its ornate face and mechanical figures like one of Michel's alchemical diagrams made into a three-dimensional object. Then into the World Court offices, where they talked to group after group about the situations on Mars and Earth. UN officials, national government representatives, metanational executives, relief organizations, media groups. Everyone wanted to know what was happening on Mars, what Mars planned to do next, what they thought of the situation on Earth, what Mars could offer Earth in the way of help. Nergal found most of the people he was introduced to fairly easy to talk with. They seemed to understand the respective situations on the two worlds. They were not unrealistic about Mars's ability to somehow save Earth. They didn't seem to expect to control Mars ever again. Nor did they expect the metanational world order of the antediluvian years to return. It was likely, however, that the Martians were being screened from people who had a more hostile attitude toward them. Maya was quite certain this was the case. She pointed out how often the negotiators and interviewers revealed what she called their terracentricity. Nothing mattered to them, really, but things earthly. Mars was interesting in some ways, but not actually important. Once this attitude was pointed out to Nergal, he saw it again and again, and in fact he found it comforting. The corresponding attitude existed on Mars, certainly, as the natives were inevitably areocentric, and it made sense. It was a kind of realism. Indeed, it began to seem to him that it was precisely the Terrans who showed an intense interest in Mars who were the most troubling to contemplate. Certain Metanat executives whose corporations had invested heavily in Martian terraformation. Also, certain national representatives from heavily populated countries who would no doubt be very happy to have a place to send large numbers of their people. So he sat in meetings with people from Arms Corps, Subarashi, China, Indonesia, Amex, India, Japan, and the Japanese Metanat Council. And he listened most carefully and did his best to ask questions rather than talk overmuch. And he saw that some of their staunchest allies up to that point, especially India and China, were likely in the new dispensation to become their most serious problem. Maya nodded emphatically when he made this observation to her, her face grim. "We can only hope that sheer distance will save us," she said. "How lucky we are that it takes space travel to reach us. That should be a bottleneck for emigration, no matter how advanced transport methods become. But we will have to keep our guard up forever. In fact, don't speak much of these things here. Don't speak much at all." During lunch breaks, Nergal asked his escort group, a dozen or more Swiss who stayed with him every waking hour, to walk with him over to the cathedral, which someone told Nergal was called in Swiss the Monster. It had a tower at one end, containing a tight spiral staircase one could ascend, and almost every day Nergal took several deep breaths and then pushed on up this staircase, gasping and sweating as he neared the top. On clear days, which were not frequent, he could see out the open arches of the top room to the distant abrupt wall of the Alps, a wall he had learned to call the Berner Oberland. This jagged white wall ran from horizon to horizon like one of the great Martian escarpments, only covered everywhere with snow. Everywhere except for on triangular north faces of exposed rock, rock of a light gray color, unlike anything on Mars. Granite. Granite mountains raised by tectonic plate collision. And the violence of these origins showed. Between this majestic white range and Bern lay a number of lower ranges of green hills, the grassy Alps, similar to the greens in Trinidad, the conifer forests, a darker green. So much green, again Nergal was astounded by how much of Earth was covered with plant life, the lithosphere smothered in a thick ancient blanket of biosphere. "Yes," Michel said, along one day to view the prospect with him. "The biosphere at this point has even formed a great deal of the upper layer of rock. Everywhere life teems. It teems." Michel was dying to get to Provence. They were near it, an hour's flight or a night's train. And everything that was going on in Bern seemed to Michel only the endless wrangling of politics. "Flood or revolution or the sun going nova, it will still go on. You and Sachs can deal with it. You can do what needs doing better than I." "And Maya even more so." "Well, yes, but I want her to come with me. She has to see it or she won't understand." Maya, however, was absorbed in the negotiations with the UN, which were getting serious now that the Martians back home had approved the new constitution. The UN was turning out to still be very much a Metanat mouthpiece, just as the World Court continued to support the new co-op democracies, and so the arguments in the various meeting rooms and via video transmission were vigorous, volatile, sometimes hostile. Important, in a word, and Maya went out to do battle every day, so she had no patience at all for the idea of Provence. She had visited the south of France in her youth, she said, and wasn't greatly interested in seeing it again, even with Michel. "She says the beaches are all gone," Michel complained, as if the beaches were what mattered to Provence. In any case, she wouldn't go. Finally, after a few weeks had passed, Michel shrugged and gave up, unhappily, and decided to visit Provence on his own. On the day he left, Nergal walked him down to the train station at the end of the main street and stood waving at the slowly accelerating train as it left the station. At the last moment, Michel stuck his head out a window, waving back at Nergal with a huge grin. Nergal was shocked to see this unprecedented expression so quickly replacing the discouragement at Maya's absence. Then he felt happy for his friend. Then he felt a flash of envy. There was no place that would make him feel so good to be going to. Not anywhere in the two worlds. After the train disappeared, Nergal walked back down Kramgasse in the usual cloud of escorts and media eyes and hauled his 2.5 bodies up the 254 spiral stairs of the monster to stare south at the wall of the Berner Oberland. He was spending a lot of time up there. Sometimes he missed early afternoon meetings. Let Sachs and Maya take care of it. The Swiss were running things in their usual business-like fashion. The meetings had agendas and started on time, and if they didn't get through the agenda, it wasn't because of the Swiss in the room. They were just like the Swiss on Mars, like Jürgen and Max and Priska and Sibylla, with their sense of order, of appropriate action well performed, with a tough, unsentimental love of comfort, of predictable decency. It was an attitude that Coyote laughed at or disdained as life-threatening. But seeing the results in the elegant stone city below him, overflowing with flowers and people as prosperous as flowers, Nergal thought there must be something to be said for it.
He had been homeless for so long. Michel had his Provence to go to, but for Nergal, no place endured. His hometown was crushed under a polar cap. His mother had disappeared without a trace, and every place since then had been just a place, and everything everywhere always changing. Mutability was his home, and looking over Switzerland, it was a hard thing to realize. He wanted a home place that had something like these tile roofs, these stone walls, here and solid these last 1,000 years. He tried to focus on the meetings in the World Court and in the Swiss Bundeshaus. Praxis was still leading the way in the response to the flood. It was good at working without plans, and it had already been a cooperative concentrating on the production of basic goods and services, including the longevity treatment. So it only had to accelerate that process to take the lead in showing what could be done in the emergency. The four travelers had seen the results in Trinidad. Local movements did most of it, but Praxis was helping projects like that all over the world. William Fort was said to have been critical in leading the fluid response of the collective Transnat, as he called Praxis. And his mutant metanational was only one of the hundreds of service agencies that had come to the fore. All over the world, they were taking on the problem of relocating the coastal populations and building or relocating a new coastal infrastructure on higher ground. This loose network of reconstruction efforts, however, was running into some resistance from the Metanats, who complained that a good deal of their infrastructure, capital, and labor were being nationalized, localized, appropriated, salvaged, or stolen outright. Fighting was not infrequent, especially where fights had already been ongoing. The flood, after all, had arrived right in the middle of one of the world's paroxysms of breakdown and reordering, and although it had altered everything, that struggle was often still happening, sometimes under the cover of the relief efforts. Sachs Russell was particularly aware of this context, convinced as he was that the global wars of 2061 had never resolved the basic inequities of the Terran economic system. In his own peculiar fashion, he was insistent on this point in the meetings, and over time it seemed to Nergal that he was managing to convince the skeptical listeners of the UN and the Metanats that they all needed to pursue something like the Praxis method if they wanted themselves and civilization to survive. It didn't matter much which of the two they really cared about, he said to Nergal in private, themselves or civilization. It didn't matter if they only instituted some Machiavellian simulacrum of the Praxis program. The effect would be much the same in the short term, and everyone needed that grace period of peaceful cooperation. So in every meeting he was painfully focused and fairly coherent and engaged, especially compared to his deep abstraction during the voyage to Earth. And Sachs Russell was, after all, the terraformer of Mars, the current living avatar of the great scientist, a very powerful position in Terran culture, Nergal thought, something like the Dalai Lama of science, a continuing reincarnation of the embodiment of the spirit of science, created for a culture that only seemed to be able to handle one scientist at a time. Also, to the Metanats, Sachs was the principal creator of the biggest new market in history, not an inconsiderable part of his aura. And, as Maya had pointed out, he was one of that group that had returned from the dead, one of the leaders of the First Hundred. As all these things, his odd, halting style actually helped to build the Terran's image of him. Simple verbal difficulty turned him into a kind of oracle. The Terrans seemed to believe that he thought on such a lofty plane that he could only speak in riddles. This was what they wanted, perhaps. This was what science meant to them. After all, current physical theory spoke of ultimate reality as ultra-microscopic loops of string, moving supersymmetrically in 10 dimensions. That kind of thing had inured people to strangeness from physicists. and the increasing use of translation AIs was getting everyone used to odd locutions of all types. Almost everyone Nergal met spoke English, but they were all slightly different Englishes, so that Earth seemed to Nergal an explosion of idiolects, no two persons employing the same tongue. In that context, Sax was listened to with the utmost seriousness. "The Flood marks a breakpoint in history," he said one morning to a large general meeting in the Bundeshaus's National Council chamber. "It was a natural revolution. Weather on Earth is changed, also the land, the sea's currents, the distribution of human and animal populations. There is no reason in this situation to try to reinstate the antediluvian world. It's not possible. And there are many reasons to institute an improved social order. The old one was flawed, resulting in bloodshed, hunger, servitude, and war, suffering, unnecessary death. There will always be death, but it should come for every person as late as possible, at the end of a good life. This is the goal of any rational social order. So we see the Flood as an opportunity, here, as it was on Mars, to break the mold." The UN officials and the MetaNat advisors frowned at this, but they listened, and the whole world was watching. So that what a cadre of leaders in a European city thought was not as important, Nergal judged, as the people in their villages, watching the man from Mars on the vid. And as Praxis and the Swiss and their allies worldwide had thrown all their resources into refugee aid and the longevity treatments, people everywhere were joining up. If you could make a living while saving the world, if it represented your best chance for stability and long life and your children's chances, then why not? Why not? What did most people have to lose? The late metanational period had benefited some, but billions had been left out in an ever-worsening situation.
This ends side one of cassette 6. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.